everyone. You're listening to America's Homegrown Veggie Show. My name is Kate Copsey, and I am the host of the show. You can contact me from my webpage, katecopsey.com, or through America's Web Radio Station site. This morning, we are going to talk with Dr. Jean Giacomelli about space-age tomatoes and some of the great things that they're doing through the University of Arizona in Tucson. Good morning, Jean, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Kate. It's a great privilege to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. And you are the director of the Controlled Environment Agricultural Center in the Colleges of Agriculture. So let's start with your background in agriculture and how you came to be leading a department that's looking at developing plants and environments for space ages and polar regions and the whole kit and caboodle.
Well, our focus is on growing food to feed people here on Earth and beyond. My background and my directorship here at the Controlled Environment Agriculture Center at the University of Arizona is to work with faculty, an interdisciplinary faculty of scientists, plant scientists, for example, and engineers, to solve the problems and the challenges of growing food for us here on Earth and beyond. My background is engineering as well as agriculture. I came from a small farm on the East Coast, but I've always been intrigued about designing systems as an engineer might that could produce crops any time of the year in any place. Any location that we'd like that to happen. As a result, I began focusing on controlled environment agriculture using hydroponics to provide the nutrients and water to grow the crops inside, for example, primarily here on Earth, what we do is inside greenhouses, which represent the controlled environment.
But I think from, reading about some of the things that you guys do that down there, with the controlled environments that you use, the premise is that, I guess, in environments like the South Pole, they need to be able to grow their own food year-round in these environments rather than importing food. So what exactly... does all that type of thing, when it's self-contained, what exactly, in an overview, would that entail?
Essentially to be locally grown and to produce your crops when you want them, which crops you want, can be done in controlled environment greenhouses around the world or in controlled growth rooms like we have at the South Pole. Don't think... In the harsh climate of the South Pole, we have a greenhouse that's exposed to the winds and the snow and the 24-hour darkness. It's actually a room, well-lighted, with warm temperatures for growing plants, high humidity, using artificial lights. That's high-pressure sodium lights, much like at football stadiums, that can produce all kinds of green crops, lettuces, herbs, but also the flowering and fruiting crops like tomato, cucumber, melon, sweet pepper. In fact, you can really grow almost anything in a hydroponic system in a controlled environment. You get a bit challenged and not so practical when you think about fruit trees, but okay, there are people even considering blueberries inside these kind of systems. But there... the applications of the technology that we know and have studied for 30 or 40 years here in North America and around the world uses hydroponics to provide the water and nutrients to the plants and inside a controlled environment manages the temperature, humidity, light, and carbon dioxide as the primary environmental considerations to grow the crop. We also, of course, require, I wouldn't say specialized labor, but certainly labor that appreciates growing a plant in these situations and maybe have studied. We do send our students down to operate this system, and we do support its operation at the South Pole from here in Tucson. It's called telepresence or telerobotics, whatever word you want to use, but basically it means remote controlling of the environmental system at the South Pole, 12,000 miles away from Tucson, from our offices. And then the people on site do the seeding, the harvest, and the eating, of course. they have no option. I mean, there is no fresh produce that can come in for about 8 months of the year to that part of the world because of the inclement weather. It's just too cold, too dangerous to bring in any kind of flight. So they close the South Pole Station, which is operated by the National Science Foundation, and which is supported, at least our small part, is this growth chamber. By the way, it's about the size of a small kitchen, about 240 square feet, 25 square meters, if you will. And it can produce all these crops, a head of lettuce, for example, in about 45 days from seeding. And it offers a salad for every person every day of the year. That's kind of a goal. But it does even much more than that, particularly for South Pole, and what will be important for the moon as well and beyond. It offers a green growing plant in a harsh environment that they only see the blackness of night or the blue-yellowish color of the lights. Now they can walk into this grow room. In fact, they can sit in front of it in a small anteroom. We call it our enviro room, and watch the plants grow. We got started, really, because of the demand for specialized applications. And NASA comes to mind.
Yeah.
I grew up in space age, quote unquote, as a child in the 60s, and learned to appreciate what we can do with technology. But we also recognize, and I came to recognize later, that more important, or I should say as a complement to engineering technology, is the biology of life and the life support that's needed to keep people alive on other planets. Not just for food, and that's our lunar greenhouse program that we're working with right now. It's supported by the NASA Steckler Space Grant Program here at the University of Arizona, where there's a number of faculty from University of Arizona and from other countries of the world working with us. And the program is to develop a bioregenerative life support system. And that simply means using plants in a controlled environment to produce food, but also to produce the oxygen that we breathe and absorb the CO2 that we give off. Let the plants take our CO2 and give us back oxygen, just like they do here on Earth.
That has to be a very fine, I guess, balance. I mean, if you had people moving around in and out of that, how would you control to make sure that things don't get out of whack? How do you balance that? Is that all done, again, from your control systems in the office?
Well, we like to think that it comes from our expertise, and we are learning as we go. The South Pole is a good example in that it offers the growing area, the growing room for the plants, and a separate room where people go to enjoy. What would happen on the space base on the moon or Mars would be that these growing rooms would be isolated. People would go in and work in there, but the oxygen that comes to them would be taken out of that room. Cafeteria, for example, process then, you exchange food that people will eat for carbon dioxide that they give off as that goes to the plant. And then the plant gives back oxygen so that people can breathe.
And it sounds almost like a logical balance, you know, between the symbiotic relationship between it. But I guess, is that slightly different if you've got trees in there as well, like you mentioned blueberries and maybe the fruit in trees? Would it be maybe slightly different if do they use different amounts?
Well, I think you're really on to one of the major challenges. These systems are representing what we have here on Earth, our biosphere, which gives us oxygen and CO2 back and forth with plants and people, animals, and microbes. In space or in another planet, or even at the South Pole, we don't have that volume of trees and oceans and soils, which act as a buffer. We have to be in more precise and quick control of the environment so that we maintain that balance. And in fact, we will use techniques that will allow us to be flexible, meaning that the bioregenerative life support, keeping the plants alive, will be primary, but the response in the plants will be used by people, but there'll also be other means that the more physical, chemical means that are used right now, like on the space station, to maintain life. I mean, there's no plants providing oxygen on the space station. NASA and other space agencies have figured out how to do it biochemically and chemically in space. So the bioregenerative allows us to have a secondary approach to life support, and ultimately, as we go farther and farther away from Earth, where we can't bring the resources quickly and easily and cost-effectively, we will have to mine those resources from the asteroid or from Mars and allow our small biosphere of life support, our plant systems, to keep us alive. And I find that an amazing challenge.
Yeah.
And I recognize that to teach people on Earth how hydroponics and controlled environments can produce food for them, and learn that it's some basic things you need to understand and some things to stay away from, but basically you can have fresh vegetables for sure in your own backyard, in your own home, in your urban areas, anywhere that you'd like them, of course at a cost, but the first cost is education for teaching people how to utilize and how to grow, and obviously not fail.
But let's go for a quick commercial break, and we'll be back talking more about space age and things with Dr. Jean J. McKelly and America's Homegrown Veggies. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Dr. Elena George with your health tip of the day. Did you know that throat itching and tickling, nasal itching, eye itching, skin itching, eczema, and hives are all signs of allergy? A person suffering from allergy does not always have sneezing and a runny nose. If you have noticed that these symptoms are always present year-round, you may have allergies to what you are eating. Foods such as wheat, eggs, dairy products, and corn are present in most foods. Corn in particular is present in most processed foods and soft drinks in the form of high fructose corn syrup. Completely removing these foods from your diet for at least 2 months can in some cases stop the symptoms. Keeping a food diary or getting tested for food allergies is the fastest way to find out what foods are causing your symptoms. If you think you have a food allergy, it is important to see a doctor who specializes in the diagnosis and treatment of allergy. By rotating the food into the diet once every 2 weeks, allergies can be controlled and you can still eat the food.
Officer's Oath is a story that everyone should read. It is not a birther story. It is rather the story of a man, Terry Lakin, who made a principled decision to adhere to the oath he willingly took as an officer in the United States Army. It is a story of the personal consequences of that decision and the far-reaching effect it has had on the eligibility issue. Jack Cashel, author of numerous books, assisted Terry in telling his story. David Mercado, a New York-based author, has interviewed and written vignettes of the many people who contributed to Terry's case. The book is a complete story of Terry's decision, the immediate consequences, and the long-range effect of Terry's choice. Please visit OfficersOath.com today and pre-order the book now. That's OfficersOath.com.
Quick Stakes. That's QUIK steaks are not just for surveyors. They are great for family and community gardens. Go online to www.quicksteak.com or contact your local land surveying supply dealer and get you a box of quick steaks. You'll love them every year when you plant your garden. Again, that's quick steaks, QUIK steaks, the truly preferred way to stake and identify what's in your garden now.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Welcome back to America's Homegrown Veggie Show. Remember, you can catch up with us on Facebook at America's Homegrown Veggies. And if you miss any shows, you can find them on americaswebradio.com webpage, and you can find them on iTunes. This morning, we are talking with Dr. Jean Giacomelli about developing vegetables and environments that are self-contained, that can be used in polar regions, deserts, and other harsh environments, including Luna, I guess. And Jean, we were talking a little in the last segment about getting everything in balance. Obviously, if you're out in on the moon or something like that, there are no natural gases, I guess. So you'd have to take the gases with you and set up this system all in sort of a self-contained system. You take it up on a spaceship, and then sort of everything, you've got everything to start it, from the gases to the seeds and the mediums and the feeds, and then it becomes self-contained after that. Would that be right?
That's a good way to look at it. Yes, you have to start off, quote-unquote, seed the system, if you will, no pun intended. But by seeding, I mean you need to bring the environment and its components, and we can review those a little bit, and get them in working order with the proper controls. And the plants do what they do naturally. They grow. You take a seed, you provide warmth, so you have to have some air temperature. You provide water and ultimately some nutrients in the water. You know, we grow soilless culture hydroponically with no soil. And the plants begin to grow, and in doing, they consume carbon dioxide that you have to either provide in hand, or on Mars, there's a lot of it. So you can extract it and use it inside your facility. And in return, the plants give you oxygen, what's called photosynthesis. That's the biological term for the plants taking carbon dioxide, growing, meaning making biomass of themselves, and ultimately food products. Getting off oxygen requires light. And that is, light is the most limiting factor in all systems, whether they be here on Earth, at the South Pole, or on the Moon or Mars. Light from the sun we think of as being free, quote-unquote. And in essence, in the fields, it is. Light is available only during the daylight period. Okay, we have a dark period. If we go indoors, however, we can provide light artificially from lamps 24 hours a day if we want to. Of course, most crops don't like 24 hours a day because they've been developed under the natural cycles of the day-night here on Earth. But lettuce, for example, will grow quite well, 24 hours of lighting a day. The challenge, of course, is where do you get the energy to operate those lights? And in doing so, we have to consider alternative energy sources. In fact, on Earth, we use electric power that comes from our power plants. Or, more and more, people are beginning to consider how they can use the photovoltaics from the sunlight to produce electric power. But the best, most efficient thing to do is have the sun directly come to the plant so that it's a direct use. There's no interchange and loss of energy along the way. To do that, however, you need a greenhouse. A greenhouse is a building that can provide the temperature and humidity and CO2 environment and allow the sunlight to come in. And these are being commercially used for growing many of our lettuces, our tomatoes, our sweet peppers, even strawberries, raspberries, and other crops. on the earth today. But there's a lot of interest in this topic of urban agriculture, is bringing greenhouses or bringing agriculture into the cities in very expensive land areas where you can't build a farm, but you might be able to build a building and grow crops indoors using artificial lighting. And there's a lot of discussion, there's a lot of development going on about that. And we are, to some extent, at the forefront of using this technology in our controlled rooms, such as we're doing at the South Pole, and in our lunar greenhouse, which, by the way, you can see these at our website, and I hope you'll be able to distribute that to your audience.
Oh, sure. I think that's how I found you in the first place, because, I mean, I was just absolutely, I guess, fascinated by how all this this works. But when I've grown plants indoors versus outdoors, they taste better outdoors, and some of that, I think, is the when you've got wind and direct sunlight and the stresses of outdoors intensifies the flavor just a little. How would you go about, simulating that inside? Do you kind of give it the occasional blast of wind from fans or something?
Well, we there's always air movement. Of course, it's nowhere near like Superstorm Sandy. You know, that's going to be a challenge.
We hope not.
I hear what you're saying. The vegetables, like the lettuces, will come out to be much more tender in our controlled environments because they're not subjected to the strong winds, the harsh nights, insects and diseases, for that matter. But, for example, tomatoes. In our controlled environments, we can change the flavor and the taste of the tomato. And this is an argument that you can never win. Everybody grows the best tasting tomatoes, and I don't try to change that. But I do say this: that if you like a tomato that is changed by the way we fertilize, for example, you can give a tomato plant in a hydroponic system a salt stress, meaning that we over fertilize a little bit. Maybe that's the safest way to say it, with natural fertilizers, natural salts. And it stresses the plant ever so slightly to make it sweeter, give it a more intense flavor. If you do it too much, you can kill this in your garden. But you can do it in a hydroponic system because the hydroponics is constantly recycling all the water and the nutrients that you use. And in the result is a tomato that can give you a flavor that's more intense.
Huh.
Now, people also will say, I've grown them indoors or in such a way, and they don't have a good flavor. And I ask them then, well, what was the real environment that you provided? Did you give the plant what it really needed because of that lack of whether it's nutrient or water at a sufficient time or the true light intensity? You mentioned that, which can easily happen in these non-field environments, even in a greenhouse. Therefore, you can then come to a conclusion that hydroponics doesn't taste good, or greenhouses make watery tomatoes, whatever it is. And I usually find that you just did not provide everything the plant needed to have a successful and a good tasting crop. The point is, we know how to do it. Our challenge is teaching people and others to be able to do it on their own, to do it continuously, and that's why our short courses are not the university level courses, but the application hands-on courses. You get into our greenhouses and you get your fingers green, from the tomato by working with them, and it's amazing how the success can be improved by just one course, for example.
Yeah, and I would think if you're down in the South Pole and haven't seen a fresh vegetable for 3 months, regardless of how a tomato is actually kind of produced, it would taste absolutely wonderful to you, because obviously if you're deprived of it. And I would imagine the same in sort of maybe arid areas as well. I noticed that... You actually adjust the input? So you feed them, is that an external, or do you use kind of one of these aquaponic ideas where you've got the tilapia in the base which are producing the food to which feeds the plant?
Aquaponics is different from what I've been talking about. Aquaponics is a combined fish and plant growing system where the waste product from the fish is processed and then given to the plant in a recirculating system, usually with hydroponics because the fish are in water. And we do this as well. We have demonstrations of that here on campus. That's not what we have been talking about, though. We utilize for our hydroponic system inorganic fertilizers, you know, the powders that you can buy and dissolve in water.
Okay.
And that's not your traditional organic that people like to think about, but it is a demonstrable and prescribed way of providing success for almost anyone who tries and learns and gets some experience. The organic approach is growing, and it's becoming very, very interesting, and ultimately in the long-term sustainability of the planet and of growing systems on any planet, the recycling of organic nutrients into a system like this will be invaluable and will be necessary. But at this point, we are not for space applications, are not focused on using fish to provide the waste products and the nutrients for the plant.
Yeah. So as of right now, the nutrients are having to be brought in along with the seeds and that type of thing. Would that be right?
Actually, yes. Yeah. We estimated that if you take our system, and by the way, the lunar system is a unit that's 18 feet long, 5.5 meters in length, and about 7 feet in diameter. Envision this cylinder. 7 feet is about 2.1 meters. So this cylinder, if you have this system and you bring your body weight, figure out your body weight in fertilizers, inorganic fertilizers, with you, you can feed yourself and keep yourself alive for 1 year on this planet. That's the trade-off. You see, if you can just bring your body weight, an additional weight a person, and use the system, you can recycle your oxygen and CO2 and have about half of your nutrient calories, okay? Not all of them, about one half, that's our goal. But all of your oxygen and all of your fresh water can be recycled through the system for 1 year for one person. And that, in the long term, makes a lot of sense as opposed to having to bring your oxygen and your filtration systems and everything that we use now on the space station as your primary source of fresh water and oxygen. And, oh, by the way, this system also provides you half of your calories in the form of nutrients in vegetables.
Yeah. So, And psychologically, I think it would be a big boost as well. But, you know, we need to take another quick commercial break here. But I want to remind everyone, you're listening to America's Homegrown Veggies, and we'll be back with more from Dr. Jean Giacomelli, and we'll be right back.
Today's consumers find themselves faced with a greater variety of choices than ever before, both in the food they eat and the information they receive about that food. Feedstuffs Food Link was created to provide you with a balanced source of information for making decisions about your family's balanced diet. Visit FeedstuffsFoodLink.com to learn about your food directly from the source, the people who work every day to provide it. FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, connecting farm to fork.
Quick Steaks, that's QUIK Steaks, are not just for surveyors. They are great for family and community gardens. Go online to www.quicksteak.com or contact your local land surveying supply dealer and get you a box of Quick Steaks. You'll love them every year when you plant your garden. Again, that's Quick Steaks, QUIK Steaks, the truly preferred way to stake and identify what's in your garden now.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
You're back listening to America's Homegrown Veggie Show. I'm the host of the show, Kate Copsey, and this morning we're talking about space-age gardens with Dr. Jean Giacomelli from the University of Arizona in Tucson. Jean, we talked a little about the system monitoring inputs and outputs, and you mentioned that it's about the size of a large kitchen. It's not transported as is. It's kind of collapsed down. Is that right?
Well, the Lunar Greenhouse is designed to be collapsible, yes. It extends out to 18 feet long, 5.5 meters, but it, during shipment and transit to the next planet, it collapses down to about 4.5 feet in full 7-foot diameter. We'll all be intact. The lights will be in there. The seeds will actually be in there, so that the entire unit can be in advance of the astronauts. Will set itself down on a planet, not unlike what just happened on Mars, but with the Surveyor, deploy itself robotically with help here from Earth, and turn itself on and start growing crops. I would love to be an astronaut that arrives on Mars and can walk into my habitat and see some plants growing, and know that they are life saving and consuming CO2 and providing oxygen and food.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it would be.
Yeah, that's a long term plan to do that.
Yeah. And I read that you sometimes bury the lower part of the tent. Does that mean it kind of. But it can also be done directly on the ground as well as buried. What is the form? Why would you bury it halfway down? Is that for stability or keeping the roots cool or what?
For the moon, it would have to be completely buried beneath the surface of the soil or the regolith of the moon to protect it from micrometeorites and protect it from the cosmic rays of the sun and the solar system, because there's no atmosphere at all on the moon. When we go to Mars, there's the possibility that it could be on the surface and use direct sunlight from the sun, still having to be somewhat protected. Our growing system at the South Pole is actually inside the building, protected from the weather condition and the hot winds and the snow. Ultimately, the goal is to clean the environment. Plant. The plant is the base for everything. And the plant's limitation, light, is how you get the light to the plant. So those who are interested in what's called urban agriculture and producing plants inside of existing buildings, renovating them to grow plants, their challenge will be to make that entire south wall building the ability to bring as much sunlight as possible to grow the plants. In fact, that limits their ability to grow the plants. So do you know what some people are doing? Small businesses are producing greenhouses on the rooftops of buildings. I mean, that's wasted space in a city, and it's a valuable space. New York City has a greenhouse on their rooftop. Montreal now has a successful greenhouse, the two most that I know of in North America, and with many more planned. And what they can do is take the knowledge and the technology of hydroponics and controlled environment greenhouses that we use on Earth today in normal conditions on the ground and just move them up into the city, have them available so that you can harvest fresh vegetables by 10 a.m. each morning and have them sold, and by most part, for the evening dinner and then consumed. I mean, that's freshness you can't beat anywhere else. We look forward to that, educating more young people who want to get into this business, educating those who have investment capabilities and interests to create the businesses, and to bring the farms that have migrated away from the population centers over these past 30, 40, 50 years in North America anyway, to the California, Arizona, Texas, Florida, to the South Sun Belt, and bring it back to some extent so that we don't have to transport our crops, have them several days or weeks old if they're eaten. and have the nutrition value very high. Bring agriculture back to the cities. Bring it to the people where they live and work. And also have them recognize that their food doesn't just show up at a supermarket without great abilities, capabilities. Our farmers are great people being able to produce food to feed us. You know, 1-2% of our entire population in the United States actually are in agriculture and food production. That is, distribute that workload and distribute those systems more uniformly throughout, at least where people are living and working.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, so many of them, particularly in the middle of cities, the supermarkets have kind of disappeared, and you know the junk food that is available is not healthy, and then for the rest of us, even in suburbia, 90% of the stuff from the supermarket, even if you know Kroger's does put a little sign up that says it's local in their mind seems to be about 4,000 miles. You know, to my knowledge, nobody is producing local limes in northwest Ohio. You know, I think they've got more of a global idea on that. And the cost involved. I think the initiative is to bring it back down to the city. And I love this idea of, you know, educating people. Have you thought about... And have there been any applications in places like where they've had, for instance, Hurricane Sandy, which made such devastation? Could one of your little pods be plonked down there to start growing almost instantly to start feeding those people while they're still picking up their lives?
I there has been discussions about that. Certainly we've talked about it for many years. And there are some companies now that are looking into disaster relief, where you bring a box, a container, not unlike a tractor trailer back part, and set it down, plug it in, and in 30, 40 days you have fresh lettuce, which in situations where the water quality may not be as dependable because of the disaster, and that people need fresh produce. But I'll tell you, as far as education, we've had a great outreach into the Chicago area. I assume you have listeners in that area.
Oh, yes.
The Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago has been hosting a lunar greenhouse operations and training module, is what we call it. And it demonstrates in the museum using artificial light. You walk in there, you see lettuces growing, you see peppers growing, you see basil growing inside this little cylindrical unit, and they build the great storyboards around it to indicate how, with a controlled environment and hydroponics, you too can learn how to do this, and you can see it being done. Yes, we're looking at it for the moon and Mars and beyond, but yeah, we're also doing it South Pole. And oh, by the way, probably that tomato that you've eaten, if it's in the winter period or the early spring, was probably from a local greenhouse growing tomatoes in a hydroponic system. So this, as an educational tool, has been a great opportunity to show, you know, the average citizen that has not been associated with farming and agriculture, that with a little bit of expertise, a little bit of training, you know, take a short course in this. Most universities offer them around the country, as we do, and you can get into it yourself. Start a little backyard farm, so to speak, or support your local farm that might be doing this as part of their commercial establishment, and eat their locally grown vegetables and crops, and have higher nutrition, and support local industry.
Yeah,
we're really excited.
Yeah, and you know, and I certainly think, you know, when people start thinking about how much is involved in growing in different mediums. And I know originally that the hydroponics 20 years ago used a blue chemical thing to feed everything, but there are now organic options for those that want them. And it's certainly on my I want to do that list. Maybe this winter will be my winter to start playing with these things. But unfortunately, I missed the Chicago one. I hope people will go and see that. Is the experiment going anywhere else after Chicago, or is it coming back home to roost in your backyard in Tucson?
Well, it remains in Chicago into February of 2015. And our expectation is that it will continue to travel. Our next best expectation is in Phoenix, Arizona, just up the road from us in Tucson, to continue on in another science museum. But we've also had interest by communities, Tucson being one of them, other larger cities, where they want to demonstrate this kind of technology because people are very interested in it. So we're looking for outlets that where we could deploy this. It is, as we would like to think, self-contained. You need to plug it in. You need to provide water. We actually monitor it from Tucson. We have a camera in there that we can watch the plants grow. and we can monitor the environment to make sure that the plants are have the good opportunity to grow. And make sure the nutrients are there. So we support it from here, but we do ask that there is some primary person or persons that do the seeding and do the transplanting and then harvest and enjoy the crops that come out of this. So it's more than a demonstration of technology, but it is an application where people can get their hands into it and ultimately have their stomachs enjoy and appreciate what comes from it. So they really get that effect of its purpose and of its value.
Yeah, I certainly think if people in different university environments, for instance, if they'd want to take this on, but you know we need to go for another final commercial break. But come back, everyone, and listen to more about these space age applications. And we will be back in just a moment.
Today's consumers find themselves faced with a greater variety of choices than ever before, both in the food they eat and the information they receive about that food. Feedstuffs Food Link was created to provide you with a balanced source of information for making decisions about your family's balanced diet. Visit FeedstuffsFoodLink.com to learn about your food directly from the source, the people who work every day to provide it. FeedstuffsFoodLink.com, connecting farm to fork.
At Peachtree Ear, Nose, and Throat Center, they provide better quality care. They believe that excellent medical care is a right and not a privilege. They are concerned that the current economy has forced people to sacrifice their health. They have therefore reduced their prices to make it more affordable. They will continue to provide state-of-the-art care. They continue to believe that patient care counts above all else. Peachtree ENT Center, concierge medicine without the concierge price. Additional details are available at www.peachtreeentcenter.com. Call their office at 404-591-9100 to make an appointment or for more information. They are located in Atlanta at 1776 Peachtree Road Northwest, Suite 260 North Tower, two blocks south of Piedmont Hospital.
Quick Steaks, that's Q-U-I-K Steaks, are not just for surveyors. They are great for family and community gardens. Go online to www.quicksteak.com or contact your local land surveying supply dealer and get you a box of Quick Steaks. You'll love them every year when you plant your garden. Again, that's Quick Steaks, Q-U-I-K Steaks, the truly preferred way to stake and identify what's in your garden now.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hi, I hope you're enjoying America's Homegrown Veggie Show this morning. We are talking with Dr. Jean Giomacomelli about plants and environments in various locations, including space, where you don't get, and lunar, where you don't get any inputs. And we were talking actually during the break that there are so many places where this could be applied or spun off, particularly on the ground, sort of disaster areas, and maybe deserts and of any description. I guess the poles are just an extreme of this. What sort of environments would you personally like to see this going into or being tried in?
Well, I really want to see it develop more in the and in urban areas, so that we can be more cost-effective, more resource-effective using for food production. There was concerns today. I read in the paper about using too much energy to grow food that gives us too little energy, and you know. Somewhat rightfully so. On the other hand, can be more effective in greenhouse using water, recycling it, using our nutrients more effectively than in, for example, the open field. But what about if you go places where we don't have the richness of the outdoor farms that we have in the U.S., the semi-arid desert regions of the world that we're very interested in because of southern Arizona being a semi-arid desert? These places really benefit from hydroponics, using water as cost-effectively and as resource-effectively as possible to produce the most crops. These are the applications that I see are critical. And we speak about this around the country. We speak about it with our colleagues at other universities who teach hydroponics, who teach controlled environments. But we here at the University of Arizona have an annual course every April. Please look to our website if you're interested to learn more about that and learn about how hydroponics can provide the needs and how controlled environments that you build around the hydroponic system can become even more resource effective and be able to grow them locally, as we discussed, on rooftops, or in the suburban areas and places where land is not usable for other things, that these can become greenhouse operations. And I should mention that my colleagues and I have many, many years of experience in hydroponics and controlled environments from the Earth, from applications that have been developing for the past 40, 50 years here on Earth. And we've taken that and put that into our NASA project and demonstrated how controlling them and using hydroponics can work in very harsh climates where there's no opportunity to have an outdoor garden. And in the process, what I tell people is that we do learn from this, that we can feed back this information to Earth applications again, making full circle our knowledge of hydroponics on Earth in controlled environment greenhouses, which exist today commercially, producing the lettuces, the microgreens, the sweet peppers, the tomatoes, the cucumbers, and even strawberries.
Yes.
From this.
Yeah, just fun things, yeah. And if it's full circle, you know, it really does have an effect. But I think that the critical part of, you know, what you said, you've got to know really the plant. You've got to really know the biology and what a plant needs and be able to study the plant to be able to make this work correctly. Would that be right?
Absolutely. If you understand the plant's needs, you can grow that plant anywhere at any time you wish. I mean, you're going to pay a price to do it, and it better be beneficial, like on the moon or Mars or South Pole or backyard garden. It's still the same plant with the same biology and biological needs of warmth, of humidity, of moisture and nutrients and carbon dioxide, whether it's on the moon, in a greenhouse, buried, or in a greenhouse complex in California or Arizona or or New York State, or outside of Chicago or Minnesota. It's amazing. We haven't even mentioned all the growers in the Midwest and in the South that have come into these, what they're calling high tunnel greenhouses,
mm-hmm.
which are modifying the environment in their farms. They are traditional field farmers that are moving into greenhouses that don't provide all the needs of the plant, but enough to get an earlier producing plant grown in the soil, no hydroponics, that can help their market return to make them viable farmers. And they're doing darn good at it, and we're encouraging that because that's going to generate a whole new growth of young people that say, hey, these greenhouses have something, and I want to do even more. So I'll add a heater. I'll add a cooling system. I'll add automated nutrients, maybe, maybe not. Or better yet, I'll add the organic capabilities.
Yeah.
Because that's a whole market unto itself. What I like about this, and I really appreciate your audience's ear and their time and their interest, because food is so valuable to us and life-sustaining calories. But really, it's a lifestyle. It's a family thing. It's what helps us all to appreciate the good life and help us have a better quality of life if we understand it. And ultimately, if we support our local growers, our agriculturalists, and ultimately appreciate where the food comes from, I think we'll all be better in the long term. I know a lot of people who are, and I hope in the continuation of my career and the education that we bring to people around the U.S., and for that matter around the world, we have projects in other countries too, that we'll all be better for it in the long run.
I think so, and certainly with the proliferation now of small farms and but let's mention quickly that you have some videos up on YouTube, and they are under, is it under CEAC or Luna Greenhouse on YouTube?
Well, there's a combination. YouTube, if you go Lunar Greenhouse, Lunar Habitat under CEAC. You can find a number of videos. In addition, we do have a specific Lunar Greenhouse website, which points to the work we're doing right now with a lot of images. Also, our live web camera, so you can watch our crops grow at any time. We do offer presentations from our Lunar Greenhouse. It's part of our outreach for NASA. To people around the world. We've actually done some from the South Pole to people around the world through our facilities here at the University of Arizona. The technology is there to help educate people. In our short courses now, we really like people to come to Tucson, and it's usually a good time to come in April to get away from the cold and the snow in the north. But we will do live webcasting this April from our short course, so people can register and not have to go all this way. Maybe they can't, and they'll be able to participate to some extent, at least in the majority of our lectures. They do miss out on the hands-on to see the plants growing. They get to harvest some crops. They get to really appreciate the challenges. But also the successes that are there. So,
and can they sign up for that online, or is there somewhere that they have to go to for that?
Oh, yes. Go to our website, ag.arizona.edu/CEAC website. If you go to that, there's always the information about the short courses and other specialty presentations that we have available for people who are interested in learning.
And I think actually one of those videos, was that the people in Chicago that were going through the Lunar Greenhouse or milling around the school kids and things? That was up there, I believe, as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the classes that we did for students that were off campus at the high school and junior high school level. And then we brought in some people in there. No, it's not a desktop unit. This is a you walk inside this thing. You'll be part of your life will be this lunar greenhouse. So yeah, we have videos about that. We also have the live web camera at the Chicago Museum where you see plants growing. You'll go to the museum and see it firsthand, of course. Especially, they just had a huge snowstorm in Chicago. I'm sure people would love to see some fresh crops growing.
wouldn't we all? It's an inspiration to see that type of thing. It's a shame I didn't get over to see that. You said, and that's finishing February 12th. Is that right?
I believe it's sometime in mid February. But we're attempting to extend it. And if we can, we will. We have that opportunity to do so.
It's great getting kids kind of enthusiastic about being able to grow and just opening their minds to all the possibilities of where you can actually grow food. It's it would be exciting for them.
I think showing that and demonstrating that. Even for a few moments of time that they can focus, because you know children, that'll stick in their mind, and someday we'll have new systems, better food systems, and an understanding that we're all going to need to survive with a good quality of life here on this planet.
And you only need one or two of those kids to be really enthusiastic to come down to then translate that into a career to really get enthusiastic and be able to do something. But, you know, we're right at the end of the show, Gene. But I want to thank everyone for listening to America's Homegrown Veggie Show. I think this has been a great show. The possibilities are just endless. I love what you're doing down there, Gene. I hope maybe I can get down to Tucson and take a look at it.
We would love to have you. We would invite you. We do have tours for our facilities.
Okay, everyone. We'll be back next week with another show talking all about growing veggies, this time probably on the earth. But have a good gardening week, everyone, and join me back here next Saturday.